No, I do want to begin with a bit of good news, and I think this is a legitimate point, and that is that even though we have elected but the country has elected a very right-wing government, I think the good news is that we didn't really mean to do this. I'm quite serious. What I mean is we didn't actually mean to elect a right-wing government. In the sense that what this shows, what this election indicates, in fact, is that there is not, in fact, a swing in the country to the right as it might appear. There was an interesting study done on this election, comparing it with the last election. The results, I don't know if you saw, that was in the Globe and Mail last week. It was studied by four academics from York University, and they looked at the voting patterns quite carefully between this and the last election. And what they concluded was that the difference between this and the last election was all revolved around one issue, really, and that was the issue of corruption. And actually, on the other issues, there was really no substantive change. So in other words, the good news is, this does not represent a swing to the right in the country. Now, the bad news is, of course, that we have elected a very right-wing government, and that is, unfortunately, inescapable. And the problem with this is that even though it's a minority government, the potential for it to do serious harm to what is really a relatively progressive social and political system in Canada is very real. You know, of course, in the last 20, 25 years, we've seen the dominance of Thatcherism and Reaganism or neoconservatism sweep across. Certainly across Britain and definitely across the United States, and we see the incredible impact of that. We've seen that in Canada as well. The impact of that has been felt in Canada. But I guess to a certain extent, I think we've managed to avoid the worst excesses of that. And we've avoided it despite the very determined efforts of a very small, vigorous, virulent group of right-wing lobbyists, agitators, advocates, whatever you want to call them. And sadly, of course, our new prime minister is somebody from that very small elite of right-wing advocates. And of course, if we take a quick look at the cabinet, we see the potential for real damage. Jim Flaherty as finance minister, I mean, this is a man who was a former finance minister in Ontario, very right-wing, extreme right-wing, to the right of Mike Harris, probably, and probably best known in Ontario for his decision or his advocacy that the homeless should be dealt with by jailing them. So we get a sense of the kind of social policy we're in for. And then in defense, we have Gordon O'Connor, a former general, turned defense lobbyist, now going to be the defense minister, so we can see there's going to be ever more pressure for beefing up the size of the military, getting more deeply involved in the war on terror, all this sort of thing. And in the environment position, which is, of course, a key position, one of the positions you hope in the government might, bring some sort of pressure from the environmental perspective onto issues like, for instance, the oil sands and the incredible problems we have not dealing with our Kyoto targets. You know, they've appointed Rona Ambrose, who is, in fact, a former environmental advisor to Ralph Klein. So we begin to get a sense of the potential scope of the problem. I guess I was reminded in a way of a little story that appeared in the National Post a few years ago. It was a story about a Louisiana man who in his 50s, he goes into a bank in Louisiana. He slips the bank teller a hold-up note and then goes outside to in front of the bank and waits for the police to come, and then he surrenders himself and ends up arrested, convicted, goes to jail. Kind of a bizarre little story, doesn't make any sense, until you find out that the man has colon cancer and has no health insurance, as 42 million Americans don't. And in fact, the only way he can get health, get some kind of treatment for his colon cancer, is to, in fact, end up in jail where there's some minimal kind of access to treatment. Now, this is this story was actually in the Post. It was a kind of a cute little item, a sort of little, you know, they thought it was a kind of cute little crime story and sort of like put on the page for a little sort of brightener, you know, this is your kind of morning refresher. In fact, of course, we can see that that's just an absolutely tragic story, and it reminds us just of how absolutely precious our healthcare system is. And of course, this brings us to the subject of how, in fact, our Medicare system has been kind of in the crosshairs of the of this right-wing movement in Canada for a long time. In fact, if we go back and look back in the 60s, it was the National Citizens Coalition, which was a group started by Colin Brown, a right-wing businessman who got business groups together to fund the National Citizens Coalition with a specific purpose of fighting Medicare, of, in fact, hoping to block Medicare from going through. And they put up a very vigorous fight. In the end, they lost. But the National Citizens Coalition stayed around as a very vocal group of right-wing activism on the part of very powerful business lobbying. And, of course, we know that Stephen Harper went on to become president of the National Citizens Coalition in the late 90s. And in 2002, was awarded its highest honor, its Medal of Freedom, for his what they consider to be his outstanding commitment to the causes of the National Citizens Coalition throughout his lifetime. Among the other recipients of this Medal of Honor, you may be interested to learn, were Conrad Black. And that hostility to Medicare remains today in the trenches of the right-wing movements. In fact, it's quite pronounced. In the National Post, even just last week, they referred to our Medicare system as, they described it as a Soviet-style system. And I sort of sense that they weren't meaning that in some kind of complimentary way. And Harper himself has been very critical of our entire social welfare system. Of course, he's referred to Canada as a second-tier socialist country. And at one point in 1989, he urged the Reform Party turn itself into a Canadian version of Thatcher, of the Thatcher-Reagan phenomenon. Now, sadly, he doesn't talk like that anymore, so, you know, the public doesn't have a sense of these views, and the media, as we saw in the last campaign, just simply let him kind of morph into this apparently more moderate character. I was struck the way they just wouldn't bring up these examples of his past. You know, it'd be like if Maude Barlow suddenly sort of presented herself as, you know, sort of an advocate for Bay Street, and the media sort of didn't bother mentioning that there was this other kind of stuff she'd done in the past. You know, Harper, of course, now is extremely careful to avoid mentioning anything about his past opposition to social programs or certainly to Medicare, and tries to present himself as a real moderate. I remember the Globe, about 2 weeks before the election campaign, they ran a sort of banner headline across the front page of the headline, said, Harper has evolved, he says. And you know, this passes for sort of a news story. And it just sort of strikes me, like, you know, what should we believe if we're trying to get a sense of where Harper really stands on a vital issue like Medicare? You know, should we look at everything he's done in the past 3 decades, everything he's done and said when he was in those right-wing movements and an activist with the Reform Party, a leading theorist of Reform Party theory? Or should we just kind of look at what he said in the last 2 months when he's been out there in front of the cameras and he's been trying to win an election and trying to win votes, particularly in parts of the country like Ontario, which are particularly, attached to Medicare? I mean, you know, if you had to choose between which of those two versions of Harper you'd pay attention to, I don't know, it's a really hard choice, but the media seems to think we should just listen to what he says recently. Now, it strikes me, if we want to get a sense of what Harper thinks on some of these issues, In fact, we could look at even some of the things he's directly proposing now. If we look, for instance, at his child care, his ideas on child care, I think we see that, in fact, we see the kinds of attitudes he has towards social programs that are really quite applicable, I would imagine, as well, to his attitude towards Medicare. I mean, of course, we're all aware of the serious need in this country for some kind of child care. You know, we have 1 million preschoolers with working mothers, many of whom are in fact, most of whom are in financially difficult situations. We know that period in a child's life is absolutely crucial in terms of their social, psychological, intellectual development. And yet, do we really know what's happening to those 1 million children? You know, while their mothers are at work every day, it strikes me as a kind of important question, not just in terms of how they're doing and their families are doing, which is vital questions, but how we are going to be doing as a society. It strikes me that what happens to those children is going to have an enormous impact down the road on things as various as our national productivity and our national crime rate. And this is really something we should be paying attention to. Now, fortunately, the issue of early childhood development is actually one that's been very closely studied. There's a lot of information on this, and there's a lot known about it, and there's a lot known of how to address this problem of children and what happens to them when their parents aren't there. And we even have examples of very sophisticated early childhood education programs in Europe, particularly in Scandinavia, right here in this country in Quebec. And yet, what are we learning from this? What are we taking from this? Look at the way our politicians address this problem. Now, in the last election, the NDP, of course, has been out in front for a long time on this issue, and they had a progressive program to try and develop a meaningful early childhood education program. The Liberals, at least finally, after years of promises on this, finally acknowledged the need for a child care program, didn't properly want to fund it, but at least proposed and came up with an agreement to actually develop a early childhood education program, national child care plan, in which you know, there would be some attempt to address the issue, although it had the serious problem in that it would allow profit-making ventures in on the plan, which was a serious problem. But then let's get to the Conservatives. The Conservatives have absolutely no plan in terms of child care. In fact, I think it's very misleading the way the media keeps talking about Stephen Harper's child care plan versus the Liberal and NDP child care plan. He does not have a child care plan. What he has is a plan to give, and in fact he's already taken the first steps to implement this, to give $1,200 a year to the families, families of children with preschool children, and to give tax credits to businesses eventually to potentially build childcare spaces. You know, this is kind of like if you wanted to build let's say you were starting from scratch to create, a public school system, and you sort of just gave parents a bit of money, like enough money to cover about 2 months of the school year, and they'd go out and find their own school system, and then you'd give some tax breaks to business that hopefully then would come along and maybe build a school or two. I mean, clearly this is a kind of non-program, a kind of non-plan. And I think to a certain extent it fits with the ideology of the Conservative Party, partly to encourage women to stay at home. And also, though, it fits with their ideology in the sense that kind of the idea that every man for himself, or every toddler for itself, that there will be no collective solutions, I think. We will not get together and work on collective solutions. And this really sort of highlights the theme I want to talk about tonight, the sort of two different visions of society, or two different approaches. One is, and you could call this the sort of social welfare approach, and that is that society is a community, and that everybody has a place in that community, and that there's something called the common good, which is the good of the whole community, which includes the welfare of everybody in that community. And that through collective efforts, we can address the needs of everybody in that community. And that the vehicle for those collective efforts is government, because through government, we can take care of the basic needs of everyone. We can bring in universal programs for healthcare, education, pensions, all sorts of things. And when you think about it, I mean, this is really a fantastic idea. It's a phenomenal idea to kind of harness the whole democratic system to create a system that includes everybody and that cares about the well-being of everyone. It's ambitious, but we actually have evidence that it works. In fact, we evolved a system, a fairly progressive system along these lines in Canada from in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and other countries, particularly the Scandinavian countries, have gone that much farther in really developing this idea. Now, the other idea that I want to juxtapose against this is the a vision or a way of approaching things that's a much more sort of pure capitalism. You could call this conservatism, liberalism, or neoconservatism, as it's sometimes called. The best example of this, of course, is the kind of society that's evolved in the United States. And basically what I'm talking about is rather than seeing society as a community, you see society instead as a collection of individuals all pursuing their own separate interests. So in this view, there's really no notion of a common good. There's just people out there pursuing their own competing interests. And so government isn't seen as being appropriate to kind of intervene to redistribute resources and make sure everybody is doing all right and there's some kind of protection of the vulnerable. Instead, the marketplace is the one that is left to determine how people turn out and how their lives fare. So, you know, you can have winners and losers. You can have winners that do extremely well. At the same time, you have people that just absolutely fall by the wayside. So here, you know, you can have, under this kind of scenario, you can have an incredibly wealthy society, as we do, and yet you have people that have absolutely nothing, people that are just living on the streets, and that's compatible with the notion of society because we're all just out on our own. We all have our own individual interests, and there's no sense of responsibility towards each other. And so neoconservatives are obviously hostile to the whole type of social welfare system that assumes that there's a kind of responsibility to each other, and they don't like that because what it means is that among other things, the powerful have a responsibility to the less powerful. And they would prefer to sort of roll back those gains from the social welfare system and return to a more primitive kind of market system. Now, it's not surprising, I don't think, when you sort of think of this, that this neoconservative approach would appeal to the rich and the powerful. I guess the striking thing is that in the last 20 years, this approach has made inroads with the not-so-rich and not-so-powerful, with the middle class and the working class. And it's done this despite the fact that it really doesn't serve the interests of those groups. In fact, in the last 20 years, if you look at the results, I mean, we've seen neoconservatism really have a huge impact in terms of public policy and shaping ideas and shaping the actual kind of policies that are in place. And yet, and during the same period, there's been enormous economic growth, enormous growth in income, and yet that growth has gone almost entirely to the people at the top end. And we see this, of course, particularly clearly in the United States, where there's just the biggest gap between the rich and the poor that there's been since the 1920s. And the people at the bottom have actually lost ground with the elimination of programs for the poor from the era of Lyndon Johnson and the war on poverty. I mean, now the only wars we have are wars on terrorists, that sort of thing. And the only people that have actually gained during this incredible period of growth are the people at the very top end. In fact, now they measure not just the top 1%, they're now measuring the top 10th of 1%, the top 100th of 1%, because the money just goes increasingly to this very, very select group. But if we look at the top 1%, we see that in the U.S., virtually no gains lower down, but at the top 1%, they've increased their share of the national income by 300%, like more than three times where it was just 20 years ago. Now, in Canada, we've seen a similar kind of pattern, although not nearly as dramatically, but we see the same kind of pattern that the people at the bottom end have actually, in some cases, seen their real incomes eroded. And the only real winners are in the top 10%, and particularly in the top 1%. In the top 1%, the gains, you know, the increase in the share of the national income has gone up in Canada by almost twice as much, or is almost twice as big as it was 20 years ago, compared to in the U.S. where it's above three times as big. So by any logic, when you see this kind of enormous gathering of wealth and increase in the income gap between the rich and the poor, you would think that, you know, this neoconservatism is going to be on the defensive. But of course, we see the opposite. Of course, we see it's in the ascendancy. And I would argue that it's done this largely because it's been very effective at shaping the debate and shaping the way these issues are looked at and you know, the way we approach these subjects. I mean, of course, they've been enormously effective, partly because they just have endless financial resources and they're able to finance endless think tanks and organizations and political movements. And, of course, the fact that they own the media generally is also very extremely helpful. And what they've managed to do, essentially, is, I think, to a certain extent, cast the enemy as big government. You know, the enemy, I think, to a certain extent, people used to see it as sort of big business. You know, they were the sort of powerful forces out there, you know, the big banks and the, you know, the big trust, the big interest. But the whole notion of business as kind of an overpowerful force has kind of disappeared, which is so odd. I mean, we now have, like, you know, just the other day, Exxon reported a profit of $42 billion, the biggest profit any corporation's ever had in history. And, you know, did you hear any kind of criticism or any kind of concern or any sense maybe these companies are too powerful? You know, that the idea of Exxon as sort of too powerful is, you know, just something that's not even on the political agenda. Instead, we hear about the special interests. The special interests, that's not Exxon and the big banks. The special interests are, you know, teachers, civil servants, nurses, you know, welfare recipients, all those people that are really kind of beating us up and kind of pushing us around and kind of running our society. Now, the right has succeeded in, along these lines, succeeded in kind of, to a certain extent, I think, undermining the public's confidence in government, the public's confidence the government can actually deliver on these things that it's sort of called on to do under the theory of the common good. One easy way that they've been able to undermine our confidence that government can actually deliver the programs we want is by underfunding those programs. You know, it's no mystery that if you have a program that's working and then you take away huge amounts of its funding, you know, it may not work as well. Now, I would argue, in fact, our Medicare system does still overall work very well. But the truth is that, you know, it has experienced significant cuts in spending. If you go back through the 80s and early 90s, there was no public dissatisfaction with our public health care system. It was considered a, you know, widely admired, acknowledged by all Canadians as a terrific thing. But then in the 95-96 federal budgets, there was those significant cutbacks in our spending, transfer payments to the provinces, and then, of course, cutbacks at the provincial level because of the tax cuts. So the spending on health care was reduced, and then we started having these problems. And I think, among other things, what this illustrates is that Harper will be able to actually undermine Medicare without actually taking a swipe at the Canada Health Act. I mean, all you really have to do is underfund it. You know, it always strikes me as weird when people talk about funding for healthcare. They, you know, they sort of talk, there's all these sort of alarmist stories. I mean, the media commentators are full of alarmist stories about how bad our public health care is. Did you see that story by any chance in the Globe by Margaret Wente about her hip operation? It actually was an interesting story because, first of all, just gigantic, like, you know, just all over the front of a whole section in the Saturday paper. And there's a very alarmist kind of headline all about, you know, how you need all these kind of special connections and you need to be rich in order to get a hip replacement. And then if you actually read the story about her story of her hip replacement, there's absolutely no evidence to back up her contention whatsoever. In fact, she had a very successful hip replacement. But she kind of fantasized that if she hadn't been powerful, as she apparently is, that she wouldn't have had this result. And, you know, she sort of imagines what it, you know, that it would be, that she wouldn't be able to get this if she was an ordinary person. In fact, there's no evidence whatsoever even attempted to be presented in the story that ordinary people don't get adequate treatment with hip replacements, which in fact they do. But it doesn't matter. Here was this absolutely defamatory story, just kind of anybody reading it, just, you know, with, if you don't read it carefully, you just have a sense of despair about, you know, how you have to be kind of rich and well-connected to get any kind of health care in Canada. Of course, there's the other odd thing is, you know, she's saying this about our health care. Her solution is private medicine. Well, we know with private medicine, we know that's a way that you will have to be rich and connected in order to get it. So the whole thing makes absolutely no sense. But, you know, the impact of it is just, you know, one of alarm that, you know, our system's falling apart, even though if you actually read the story carefully, what you realize is the system actually works quite well. But you know, one of the things we're always hearing about is people sort of say we can't afford our public health care anymore. You sort of wonder what they mean by that. Do they mean that, you know, that they think we should go without health care? They don't mean that. What they mean is, of course, that we should have private health care. But every single study that's looked at this in any kind of meaningful way has found that public health care is way cheaper and way more efficient. So it's hard to sort of see, you know, why you would sort of moan, well, we can't afford public health care anymore, and then decide, well, okay, we better have private health care, even though it's a lot more expensive. Similarly, you know, another big complaint is, you know, there's people sort of say the healthcare budget is just sort of gets bigger and bigger because we've got so many new technologies all the time, you know, MRIs and CAT scans, just sort of never ending, you know, and what they kind of leave out of the equation is, well, you know, maybe that means that we're getting better treatment. Like, we're able to have access to treatment that wasn't available before. But isn't that progress? So if we pay more, you know, we're also getting to live longer and live healthier for longer periods of time. Like, that doesn't strike me as such a bad deal, really. You know, rather than bemoaning this, it strikes me as something that we should be celebrating. Of course, the other argument that we hear all the time from the right is that, you know, we simply don't have any choice about whether or not we can have social programs because, you know, the global economy sort of makes that decision for us, that you know, to be competitive in the global economy, we really have to have very restricted kind of social spending. And, of course, the example that they always turn to is the example of the U.S. model. The U.S., of course, has very low taxes and very low spending, except on the military, where its spending is phenomenal, but low spending on any kind of social programs. And this is, you know, this is the model, and this, you know, is held up as being very globally competitive. And, you know, I got to admit that they're right, that model is very globally competitive. In fact, the World Economic Forum in Geneva considers it so globally competitive, the United States, that it has ranked it number 2 in the entire world in terms of global competitiveness, which is, you know, really impressive. I mean, it's almost as impressive as being number 1. But being number 1, the country that's number 1 is actually Finland. And it just so happens that Finland does things exactly the opposite to the U.S. Finland has extremely high taxes, and it has extremely large social spending and an extremely huge government. It's just the absolute mirror opposite of the U.S. And yet there it is sitting in as the number one globally competitive country in the world. So, you know, what's the answer? I mean, maybe the Finns are just kind of unusual. But then actually you look at the others that are in the top of global competitiveness, and you find that in the top six, four of them are Scandinavian countries. And they have the exact same pattern as Finland. They've got this big spending, big government, big social programs, and yet, you know, they're there in the top six. In fact, all the high tax, high spending countries of Northern Europe are in the top 20 out of more than 100 countries. So the point is, it's absolutely clear if you look at any kind of data on this, that, you know, nations can have different models. You can have the kind of U.S. model be globally competitive, or it turns out you can also have high social spending and also be globally competitive. In fact, I would argue that if anything, there's a correlation between high taxes and greater competitiveness. And there's a reason for this, that contrary to popular belief, you know, governments don't generally just take all those tax dollars and just kind of throw them down a dark hole somewhere. Sometimes they unfortunately do that, but generally speaking, in a democracy, they take tax dollars and they invest them in programs, and they invest them in vital services, and they invest them in things like healthcare, education, training, family supports, you know, providing enough money for families so that children don't go to school hungry, for instance. And that tends to make people more productive. I mean, that's why the rich and the upper middle class tend to do so well in life. You know, in addition to inheriting money, they also get the best of health care, they get the best education, they get the best training, they get the best opportunities at everything like that. They never go to school hungry. And so they tend to develop, they have a much better chance of developing to their full potential. And that's exactly what social programs do. They make that option of developing to your full potential available to everybody in the society, not just to the rich, but to everyone. And obviously that has enormous benefits to the individual, but it also has benefits to the society as a whole. I mean, think about it. If everybody has a shot at developing to their full potential, then overall you're going to have more people developing to their full potential. You're going to have a more productive economy. And that is, I think, what explains the success of the Scandinavian countries. It also is true that there's a clear correlation between high social spending and increases in the level of equality in society. I mean, it's just the numbers are striking. If you look at the Scandinavian countries and their ability to tackle problems of poverty, child poverty in the Scandinavian countries is almost non-existent. And adult poverty rates are less than half what they are in Canada and less than a quarter what they are in the U.S. Homelessness is almost a problem that really doesn't exist in most of those countries. Yeah, in fact, if you look at the Scandinavian countries, look at a country like Finland, the most competitive country in the world, and you see what's possible. It's really striking, you know, in terms of their fabulous healthcare programs, their education systems, their pensions, their unemployment insurance, their home care, their family leave programs. They're just phenomenal. Free dental care for children, free university tuition, 7 weeks paid holiday for everyone in the society. I mean, these are mind-boggling concepts. In fact, I when I was going over this list, I was so shocked. I was kind of unbelieving, so I decided to check this out with the Finnish embassy in Ottawa. And I went over and they said, oh, yeah, we, you know, they do all this. So, you know, I was going down the list and you know, yes, all this dental care, da-da-da, you know, and free university, oh, yes. And then the woman sort of hesitated, and I thought, oh, maybe I found a chink in the armor. And she said, well, it's not entirely free university tuition. And she said, yeah, the tuition is free, but we make students pay a small amount towards their living expenses. And you know, then she said, okay, and the 7 weeks paid vacation, said, oh, well, it's not quite like that. Okay, because that was the one I was really interested in. And she said, no, it's not really 7 weeks. It's 9 weeks. And she said, I was sort of incredulous, and she said, well, it's 7 weeks. Everybody gets 7 weeks. And then at the beginning of the vacation, the employer gives an extra 2 weeks pay. So I'm sort of flabbergasted, and she said, she's surprised by my surprise, and she says, well, how else would the employee be able to enjoy his or her vacation? Which I thought was a good point. But the point is that it's absolutely possible to have all these wonderful programs and be globally competitive. I mean, imagine that. Imagine we could have that here in Canada. My feeling is that if Canadians had any sense of that, they would love it. But of course, they have no sense of that because we get almost no kind of focus on this kind of thing. We get no sense that we, in fact, have a choice, that we could have these kind of programs every bit as much as the Scandinavian countries can. But the truth is that Canadians do like social programs. There's plenty of evidence of that. In fact, despite the enormous efforts of the financial elite and neoconservatism to kind of discourage us from supporting public programs and discredit government and its ability to deliver these programs, the simple truth is that Canadians remain committed to them. You know, you sometimes get the impression if you follow the media that, you know, there's nothing going on in this country but tax rage, you know, that everybody's just kind of desperate for a tax cut. I mean, it actually turns out that almost nobody wants a tax cut. Sure, if you ask people, do you want a tax cut? You know, do you want some chocolate? Do you want some ice cream? You know, everybody says yes. But if you ask them to make choices, you know, do you want a tax cut or do you want investment in healthcare or do you want investment in education? If you start asking those kinds of questions, you get very different responses. And in fact, it's striking, goes up, you know, well above 80% that the preference is for that kind of social investment. In fact, it's really only a very small group that wants tax cuts as a top priority, and that group consists almost entirely of rich older men who are experiencing bouts of tax rage, apparently. Now, you may wonder how it is I know this. I've kind of deduced this from my evidence is a publication. I don't know if you've ever seen this. It comes out in the National Post from time to time. It's called The Wealthy Boomer. And it really consists of just two things, articles about tax cuts and ads for Viagra. You know, so this makes me wonder, you know, does tax rage cause erectile dysfunction? You know, or maybe erectile dysfunction causes tax rage. But that brings me back to the good news, which is that the right is impotent. It brings back the good news that the public still does support social programs. So the point I'm trying to make with that is that the battle is not lost as long as that public support is still there. Now, I don't want to present this in some kind of overly optimistic way. I mean, it's absolutely true that huge obstacles are in the way in terms of us, you know, reestablishing strong social programs. And those obstacles just got that much bigger with the election of the Conservative government. But I do think it's important to note, to kind of put this all in perspective, I think it's important to remind ourselves, and it's very easy when we kind of get depressed about all this to lose track of sort of the broader picture. I think it's important to put it in perspective and to remind ourselves that those obstacles have always been there, that the forces of, you know, the financial elite have always tried to suppress the desire to bring about progressive change and to put in place social welfare policies that benefit the whole community, because basically they don't want to be in a position to have to contribute to that whole community. They would much rather contribute to the well-being of just themselves and their families. So that resistance has always been there. In fact, the fight to destroy the welfare state really began long before there even was a welfare state. In fact, some of the most interesting fights, you know, take place in the 1800s, the late 1800s, when the kind of, you know, union movements and populism, progressivism, those things are really sort of pushing to sort of the beginnings of the welfare state. And, you know, it's important to remember that back then, those pushing for those things didn't have the kind of resources that we have today. For one thing, they didn't have the internet. You know, much more difficult to organize. And yet they did organize, and they did fight, and they did make gains. And it's because of their fighting that we have the programs that we have today. So I thought to sort of maybe close this, and so close my remarks so we can open up to discussion, I would kind of take you back to revisit just briefly this sort of sense of struggle that they went through in the late 1800s, particularly over the fight to establish the income tax. Now, the income tax, of course, was crucial to establishing the power of government to be able to tax and then spend to put in place these programs that people wanted. But there was an enormous fight to get the income tax didn't always exist, and there were enormous battles to bring it in, and both in Canada and in the United States. And there was incredible resistance on the part of the financial elite to bring in any kind of income tax. The struggle was particularly bitter in the U.S., where the fight went all the way up to the Supreme Court. What they were resisting in the U.S. was an income tax that would have a top rate of 2%. The rich thought this was just outrageous. And in fact, in response to this income tax with a top rate of 2%, 400 of the wealthiest men in the country signed a petition saying that this income tax of 2% was put in place, they would leave the country and take their fortunes with them. And I've always found very inspiring a wonderful speech that was given by the populist leader, William Jennings Bryan, in the U.S. Congress in defense of the idea of the income tax and denouncing these scoundrels, these business leaders that were ready to pack up and leave. And whenever I sort of read this, I'm always sort of wishing if only we could have, you know, political leaders that could respond with the strength and the passion that William Jennings Bryan did when we are confronted with the same kinds of threats from business leaders that, you know, they will pack up and leave if taxes are too high. So here, for a little bit of inspiration, are the words of William Jennings Bryan from his speech to the U.S. Congress in 1894. He says, "Of all the mean men I have ever known, I have never known one so mean that I would be willing to say of him that his patriotism was less than 2% deep. If some of our so-called best people prefer to leave the country rather than pay a tax of 2%, God pity the worst. We can better afford to live without those people and their fortunes than risk the contaminating influence of their presence. Let them depart, and as they leave without regret the land of their birth, let them go with the poet's curse ringing in their ears." Thank you very much.